it's a pleasure to be here, and I join you. I think Anne provided a very interesting gateway to the discussion, and the incorporation of SBIR was extremely interesting to me. One of the things that I think we're privileged to see is a very interesting paper. It's what I like is that it's focused on the supply chain, which, as some of you have may notice, is a central policy issue these days. And it's nice to have some research that looks at it empirically. There are a lot of good things about the paper. One of the things that sort of a top line, I thought it was good to see an empirical economist as distinct from an ideological economist looking at the cultural variables of whether the Japanese model was in fact Japanese and deeply rooted in the culture and longstanding practices of that country, with the caveat that, as most of you know, that much of the Japanese success with Toyota came from the inspirations of Deming, who was, of course, not accepted in the United States very well. It's a classic problem, actually. He was very useful during World War II, but when the war stopped, we reverted to doing things less well. With the pandemic, there are a number of good things. I don't want to do the presentation, but I think Robert deserves a lot of credit for this inclusive, and I don't mean that in the traditional wonderful sense, but just the academically inclusive approach that he's taken, looking at a variety of methodological approaches in different papers. And to be a little blunt, rather than just trying to prove how much smarter he is than the other guys, he's actually trying to draw the best features out of their papers and then apply it. And I seriously commend that. The use of meta-analysis, which is what I'm describing, is only too often absent. I also like and certainly in the public policy domain, very often someone is trying to prove that one particular path will work rather than looking what the trade-offs are. Incidentally, I think the lessons from Robert's paper might be very useful to some of Anne's analysis. You know, the trade-offs are usually found in deep in the desk of a procurement officer, that it can be more green, but what does that cost either in terms of performance or simply product cost? And the related question, which goes to, I think, to the heart of some of these issues, and I commend Maurice for bringing these two together, is what are the incentives for the procurement officer? And what we saw there is most often those incentives are cost. In the old days, it used to be just cost. Now it's cost, and we splash some green paint on it. And I think it's, I don't mean to be hard, I mean to be realistic. Another element that I thought was useful was breaking down, very useful, was this efficiency as speed and effectiveness as quality. While those concepts are simple and perhaps in some cases difficult to document empirically, they're also very real. And I like that grounding in actual practice. And I particularly liked looking not only at quality, which of course you can measure different ways, and cost, which is usually straightforward, although maintenance and lifetime costs are of course extremely important, particularly in public procurement. But also I was intrigued that you used manufacturability, which so often is left out. In fact, the manufacturability and the maintenance can often be, are often linked. What does it actually cost to do this? And a related side point, which is beyond the scope of the paper, but I think interesting, who can make these? You know, if you can get cost and manufacturability, usually that means you want to go to Shenzhen. But maybe that's not where we want to go. So looking at what steps need to be taken to root the or ground the supply chain within a national or regional economy is, I think, is increasingly salient in public policy minds. I mean, you know, we have this common challenge in Europe and the US between recognizing that the global just-in-time supply chains have revealed very deep vulnerabilities, and at the same time, trying not to abandon the global trading system and the rules that guide that. There's a baby and bathwater approach that needs to be looked at. The one of the things that I will just close on that I think is particularly important is trying to see what are the incentives to how do you do this? How do you change those on the table incentives for the participants? You know, as some of you may know, I remember being in a meeting of procurement officers in Brussels, organized by the Commission, and we were talking about the importance of small companies as a way of increasing innovation and efficiency and lower costs. And one of the procurement officers said, "Well, we do that right now all the time. We'll contract with any small company as long as they have a 5-year record and substantial financial reserves and a proven contractual history," you know, which is, of course, what they don't have. Again, I could go on. I think there's, I'd be interested to see what Robert's views are, perhaps at the end of his presentation, on the how you might incorporate more an SBR type program. Just briefly, as you know, posing challenges either for prizes or for awards and the awards leading to contracts, getting those connections is, well, I think it's a major challenge in the European innovation systems, frankly, at the national level and certainly at the European level. And the addressing that is a great way to, in fact, bring down prices and incorporate, you know, one of the green innovation is how do you sidestep the existing system? Anytime I hear people saying they're going to reform public procurement, or for that matter, reform universities, I think of the Battle of Verdun with a great deal of blood and very little progress. And it's a very hard thing to do. And so rather than lament it, it's how do you bypass it? And how can you set up parallel programs which will let you circle around, as it were? In any case, forgive my enthusiasm about this paper, but I think it's really great. And also reflecting some extensive period at the National Academy of Sciences, trying to draw on the very best of our economists. To my chagrin over the years, I found that you could get our best economists for policy advice at any business school in the country, but at the business school. All right, with that, thanks very much. And Robert, thank you for a really intriguing treatise.
Well, thank you for a very intelligent and descriptive introduction already of the paper, and thanks for enjoying the paper as well. Of course, I'm going to hope to address some of the things you also raised, especially the issue of manufacturability. I think is an area that actually connects very well to what's happening in the public domain. Because we can set specifications all we want from the client side of things, but we also need to ensure that the supplier is actually able to produce whatever we want their product or service or supplies to represent. So with that being said, I hope to return to that at the end of the presentation. And now I'm going to have to move my screens around a little bit so that I can still show you and also share my screen. So I hope this works for all of you. As Charles already introduced, his paper is called Unraveling the Dimensions of Supplier Involvement, But actually, for all practical purposes, I kind of regret that I've never called this paper The Sense and Nonsense of Early Supplier Involvement, because it's by definition a more practical term. And so that's the majority of what I will be spending my time on today. As Charles already identified, the origin of the idea of early supplier involvement stems from the notion of the Toyota production system. And so here you actually see one of those manufacturing lines, assembly lines. And this idea of the Toyota production at its time was one of the biggest innovations in the field of supply chain and operations management. And there is a book that you might know if you've ever been in touch with the notion of lean or lean management. It's called The Machine That Changed the World. And actually that book itself has really changed the world in a way, because it describes some of the elements of the system that Toyota created, implemented, and designed that made it much more efficient and effective than American and European counterparts in the car industry, in the automotive industry. So they were better able to design cars that customers actually wanted. They were way faster to the market in particular, and they did so with the help of many of their suppliers. And so they really built an extensive, collaborative, dedicated supplier network. They used production and purchasing just in time and just in sequence. As a result, really since this publication in the 1980s and since that has spread, both academics and practitioners started to look at that Toyota production system to learn from it. And an element of that has become known now as early supplier involvement. And that's what I will introduce through the next couple of slides. So the question is a little bit, what is actually early supplier involvement? So we are talking specifically, and this is where you have to go with me a little bit, because I'm from the domain more of supply chain management, more of manufacturing rather than public procurement. So we have to talk about suppliers of components or modules or parts of the final product. So think back about the car. We're talking about producing many, many cars. So it's series manufacturing. And we're talking about suppliers of, for instance, wheels or dashboards or electronics that go into the car. But of course, the original equipment manufacturer, Toyota in this case, is responsible for that final product and also markets it. Now, the process that those organizations use to actually design a new product, a new car, the next car, let's say, basically typically looks like this. So they go from idea generation on the left side to building a prototype completely on the right hand side. And there are different types of assessments and developments and concepts and engineering and design in between. Of course, this is a summary, but it actually quite well represents what happens in companies. If you would ask them what their process looks like, this kind of captures it as well. And I very much realize that this process approach might look very differently for public procurement, but you can consider elements of this in the same way, and I'll explain what that means. So the notion of early supplier involvement principally means that at any one of those stages that are on this slide, you could involve or ask a supplier to contribute. Now, typically that happens when we start building a prototype. Once we end up having a sort of proof of concept or real prototype building, then we need suppliers actually to give us the wheels, to give us the dashboards, and give us the electronics for the car. But we could potentially also ask the supplier to play a bigger role in earlier stages. And that means that simply earlier stages, more to the left in this figure, represent early supplier involvement rather than later supplier involvement. And so for other types of processes in the public sector, this might actually mean the same thing, right? So the earlier involvement of suppliers means that suppliers can actually give you ideas, give you techniques, et cetera, that can be used in the subsequent definitive technical plans that you are subsequently purchasing. So it still works in theory. Now, we identify a number of challenges, and this is based on two smaller case studies that students once did at two companies, so Cooker and Daimler Shipyards. So at Cooker, this is the water boiling tap company that's quite famous, I think, for everyone that has ever renovated a kitchen. You might have it. So there were a couple of challenges that they identified when they started to try implementing early supplier involvement. First was actually on the side of the suppliers, there was an unwillingness to share information because it typically actually included intellectual property and things like that that they didn't necessarily want to share without sufficient guarantees that they would also earn an order or something like that. And they also suffered internally as well from a not invented here syndrome. So they didn't want to rely on technical expertise outside their organization because they had a feeling that they would be better off if they would do it themselves. Another particular challenge in this area is how to manage supplier involvement if there are so many, often 200 or more suppliers of one particular water tech. So how do you actually manage that? Who should you involve and who should you not involve? And there are some, if you're really interested in that, there are some interesting insights into what types of suppliers in the CrowReach portfolio, for instance, would be more fruitful to collaborate with. At Damen Shipyards, we found they were working on a project to develop condition-based maintenance, so the idea to install sensors and things like that on critical modules to monitor when and where maintenance had to take place. And they actually suffered a little bit from that because in this particular industry, those critical module suppliers are really powerful players and they started in a sort of standards competition amongst each other because they all wanted to promote their own idea of using sensors and their own interface and their own infrastructure for that. And so instead, Damen then reverted back and actually started developing its own platform for managing condition-based maintenance and then invited suppliers to join it. So it kind of failed as an early supplier initiative. So now I'm coming back to actually this idea of the Toyota way. And for that, we have to differentiate between two types of supplier involvement, or if you will, two dimensions of supplier involvement. So on the first part, what Toyota actually did, to be honest, is they extensively involved the supplier. And that refers to the delegation of responsibility for specific design tasks of components or parts to knowledgeable and experienced suppliers. And that means that what we then call a connective capacity allows an organization, a buying organization or an innovating organization, to leverage their supplier's knowledge without necessarily taking aboard all that knowledge him or herself, right? So think about the development of the next electric car. You can think about developing your own battery and then ask suppliers of batteries or other electronic components to work with you on this. But that requires you to then own and absorb all that knowledge to develop those specifications and technical details yourself. Rather, this idea of extensive involvement allows you to actually bridge the gap between the two sets of knowledge that you have internally as well as externally. And then the second dimension of supplier involvement is actually this notion of the moment of supplier involvement. So this captures the early supplier involvement, which really evolves around capturing ideas and concepts for new products from suppliers. So what did we actually do? And Charles already nicely introduced some of it. So let me just quickly glance over this. So we performed a structured literature review that covers about 11,000 MPD projects from a lot of scientific papers. So we didn't actually go to all those 11,000 projects ourselves, but we covered what was written and known about them in the literature. And that covers the entire time span from when this notion of supplier involvement first came up to 2015, because that's when we did this research first. It covers all kinds of journals and research and other outputs. So then we performed a meta-analysis of the effects of supplier involvement. And I know this is not an academic audience, but just to make sure that everybody understands that we did the right things, technically we performed a multi-level random effects multivariate meta-regression. This is completely academic knowledge. I'm perfectly aware of that, but we needed to do this because we need to account for systematic overlap between studies and effects, because one study might actually report outcomes on multiple effects. So for instance, MPD efficiency and MPD effectiveness. We also need a random effects model because we account for structural differences between studies. Simply said, not all studies are the same. So we need to kind of take that into account. And we need to perform a multivariate meta regression because we account for a bunch of moderators, bluntly put, simultaneously. Now, if you put all of that together, this is the main set of results that you get. And it's a bit hard to read, but from the top to the bottom, you can see first the main results on supplier involvement, then the sub results on the extent of supplier involvement, and finally the sub results in the moment of supplier involvement. Let me summarize that slide for you in text on this page. The table, of course, is in the paper if you're interested. What we find from this paper, from this analysis, is that the extent of supplier involvement leads has positive effects on NPD efficiency and NPD effectiveness. Now, NPD efficiency refers to the project itself, so the cost and the timeliness of performing this particular new product development project. The effectiveness instead refers to whether it actually turns out to be a better product, whether whatever we are developing is actually more innovative, it's better quality, it's more higher manufacturability and things like that. Instead, in contrast to what much of the literature says, this notion of early supplier involvement does not really help an organization to capture good ideas for innovation or better solutions, because it does not actually lead to higher NPD effectiveness. There are some beneficial effects of involving a supplier earlier, because it allows you to uncover some potential problems earlier, in particular around manufacturability or the technical details that might not even specifically work. And so the overall recommendation for any type of company really is to delegate tasks to suppliers whenever you can in new product development. And we also, as Charles already referred to, we also check whether this might differ per industry or even per country. And there are not really strong effects to suggest that this is, for instance, a typically Japanese way that would only really work in Japan. Really, we find that it works across cultural boundaries. And it also works across dimensions of performance. For instance, there are no real differences between cost and quality, for instance. And so that suggests that we really need to focus on a connective capacity to leverage this knowledge and expertise of our partners, because we know it leads to better, faster, less costly product development. Now, that sounds all nice, but that's the product development area in the private sector. What about public domain? I kind of hear you asking this. So the disclaimer that I have to put forth again is that the presented study that I've just shared with you is really about product development in the private sector. And the presented study, and that might also need some clarification, is about innovation, not procurement. So we didn't actually check whether procurement professionals were involved with those NPD projects. We only checked whether suppliers were involved and to what extent. So it's really about innovation. Now, that being said, I do think that the study and what we found there has some wider implications for different domains. So first of all, one of the things that we find is that suppliers, and this might come across a bit rash, suppliers typically do not actually know that much about your internal or external client market. And that calls to action to set functional specifications. You have to say how many cars will drive over a bridge. It's very hard to ask a supplier to estimate this. But that after that has been done, suppliers really do can help to translate those abstract requirements into more technical specifications. After all, that is basically what they do for a living. This is their expertise. They know how to create a bridge that can carry this many cars every day. And one of the mechanisms for that could be market consultation, which would allow you to discover problems with your specifications earlier. But the solution might not be then to develop more detailed specifications or change those specifications, but it could also be to revert back to a higher level, more abstract functional specifications. And that also calls for rewarding actual performance or innovation from suppliers. So delegating responsibilities to suppliers sounds nice, but it also requires you to reward that innovation from suppliers. Now, I want to spend one slide, if I still have time on that.
One slide. I think one slide we can do. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, good. One slide on some interesting research that fits into this domain that sort of stems from this initial research that we did. They're basically based on three Masterfuses projects that have been done in the last 2 years, more or less. So one project actually looked at startups And what startups need to be involved early in innovation projects by incumbent firms. So again, it's in the private sector, not in the public sector, but I think largely the same findings apply. So we find that startups are very willing to work with incumbent big organizations, but what they require, of course, is financial stability. And I think this is obvious. They need money because that's basically what they're suffering from all the time. But they also want to sit at the table with the board of directors. They want really the high level communication with the people that matter in an organization. And they don't necessarily want to be dealing with a lower level purchase category manager of a sub organization within the overall organization. So that is what startups typically require. Now, there's also research that looked at the involvement of IT suppliers in the public domain. It's a study I'm highlighting here by Adamson, actually from TU Twente. That looked at the involvement of IT suppliers in public procurement, how that works, and basically calls for interactive market consultation as the best approach to leverage their knowledge, in particular for cloud services or IT staff. And the final thing I want to highlight here is that, you know, I'm sort of signaling that you shouldn't involve your suppliers to generate IDs for you. You should develop them yourselves, or, and that's the alternative I'm highlighting here, or you can ask your customers, your clients, the public specifically, for their IDs and concepts that they might have in mind. And that's actually an area where a lot of research is being done to compare and contrast customer involvement against supplier involvement as well, also in the sphere of IT and tech. But customers do not have technical expertise, so you still need suppliers to actually then develop the solution. So I think this is my final slide, Maurice, if you'll let me. This is a thing I came across this morning, and this is actually something that I would be quite critical of on the basis of the study that I've just presented. So it's in Dutch. I'm sorry, Charles. I'm sorry, Anne, but and others. It basically says that Maastricht, which is where I live, started a search for a unique plan for a location. And you can see the location in the background. It is kind of a mess. Really, something needs to be done there. And the municipality actually calls for market parties to come up with their IDs and actually really paint outside the lines and seek the edges of what is imaginable to surprise them, right? I think our research shows that suppliers might not be the best persons, the best parties to actually do that. They should also try really to either involve customers, but also to use suppliers for their technical expertise rather than their market knowledge. So I think that's it from my side. I have a final slide that basically asks who knows best in all those areas, but basically this summarizes it. Thanks very much.